Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing the latest from Bangladesh. On August 5th, after 5 weeks of widespread university student protests and a deadly crackdown left more than 300 people dead and thousands arrested and injured, protesters managed to force Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign and flee the country. She is taking refuge in India. We should say that many say the death toll is much higher. So what led up to this and what is next? Jennifer Chowdhury is a Bangladeshi-American journalist who's been reporting on South Asian and Muslim communities in the diaspora for over a decade. Jennifer Chowdhury reports that during the height of the student protests, the military was deployed around the country. The police imposed a strict curfew with a, quote, shoot-on-site order, and the government enacted a telecommunications and internet blackout for 10 days. During the blackout, there were reports of government helicopters shooting indiscriminately at people and of officers in plain clothes raiding homes at night and arresting students as young as 17. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. I also want to give out the phone number. Jennifer will be with us for about 20 more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of what has been happening in Bangladesh, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Jennifer, you write about this in your story. I mean, it was just incredible to see so many people storm the Prime Minister's home. Were the protesters surprised at how fast all of this happened?
Yeah, I definitely think they themselves were surprised. I mean, you know, it really started out as a movement for better government jobs. And the reason why government jobs are so important for these protesters, and I have to give the background of these protesters. They're not just any students. They are like the Ivy League of Bangladesh. They come from universities such as Dhaka University, which was established even before Bangladesh was a country. It's one of the most, famed universities in South Asia and really all over the world. And so these are like the brightest and the best. And it's a public university, which means often no fee or very low fees, right? And so they should be eligible for the best of the best jobs, right? Civil service jobs especially. And these civil service jobs are so important because they have retirement benefits, they have prestige, it's an opportunity for upward mobility. And so this is why this was so important. And now how it got from that fight to the Prime Minister resigning and an entirely new interim government is an extraordinary story that I think we will need, honestly, much more in depth and years of reporting to even find out. So yes, I was in conversation with a lot of the sort of movement leaders that organically popped up, because again, this was a very decentralized movement, and there was, like you said, telecommunications blackout, so they were on the run, and so they would send me WhatsApp voice notes to kind of tell me what was going on, and none of them saw this coming. I mean, the resignation of the Prime Minister was something that they asked for way, way, way later, after, previously has been reported 300 plus deaths, but now actually the UN just today released a report that actually it's over 650. Mm.
So give us a little bit more context. I think that this is so interesting to learn that this was the Ivy League of Bangladesh. For people who don't know much about Bangladesh or haven't been following this very closely, so Bangladesh is a country of about 171 million people. According to the Asian Development Bank, almost 19% of the population lives below the national poverty line. The proportion of employed population making below $2.15 is almost 6%. There's massive inequality in Bangladesh. According to Al Jazeera, the wealthiest 10% of the population controls a disproportionate 41% of the nation's total income, while the bottom 10% receives a meager 1.31%. So what else do we need to know to put all of this in context about Bangladesh?
Yeah, this is all important, what you just said. And there's two things related to these facts and data points that are really important to understand why people were disgruntled under Sheikh Hasina and Awami League. One is the fact that any ruler that's been, or any head of government that's been in power for 15 years is inorganic, right? And what she promised during her time is a better economy, a more digitally connected Bangladesh. And all of these things, if you look at the World Bank and the Asian, you know, all of the think tanks, happened, right? The economic rise of Bangladesh from middle income status was much applauded and lauded all over the world. However, like you said, there was a huge gap between the rich and poor. So every time Sheikh Hasina would kind of, you know, make her statements, give her, you know, press conferences, and would talk about how wonderful they're doing as a country, you know, the lower and middle and lower classes would say, but we're not seeing the money, right? And so, and in response to that, she would be like, well, you know, keep your mouth shut, essentially, and I'm going to help you get there. And she had 15 years to do that, and she did that, but only for, you know, the upper classes. And so, you know, this is a big reason why they were so people, you know, and this is now also, just to clarify, has been renamed from a student movement to a people's uprising, because everyone had joined the movement at some point, which we can get into later on. But so that economic success story, in a nutshell, was falsified, right? Like, yes, the numbers are there, but the people are not, you know, reaping the benefits. And then also, the pandemic happened. There is almost a 10% inflation rate in the country. So they were very upset about that. Now, connecting the economic success to human rights is a very important factor also in what's been going on. So basically what Sheikh Hasina and her government are saying is, we will jail you. We will, you know, basically penalize you for speaking up against the government, because look, we're doing all of this work. We're taking the country places, and you're getting in the way by criticizing the government. And that should happen in no democratic country, right? Especially if you are quote unquote an elected leader that like she was. So all of these things really led to this massive anger and resentment against the government.
Can you tell us more about Sheikh Hasina and what else she has done over the past 15 years that stands out for you and the protesters you've interviewed?
Yeah, absolutely. So something that's really important to understand is who she is and who her family is. Her father, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, was he's called the father of the nation, because during 1971, which is when Bangladesh gained their independence from Pakistan. Bangladesh was, for those listeners who don't know, was formerly East Pakistan, right? So in 1947, the British left the Indian subcontinent, and it was split into two countries, India and Pakistan. Now, East Pakistan is what is now Bangladesh. And it is a country, if you look at it on a map, nestled in between India, with thousands of miles away from the mainland, which is West Pakistan, which is like what we know as Pakistan today. So, you know, it was a very interesting and sort of odd choice, which we will take forever to get into that. But so her father was a really beloved political leader from the 50s onwards. And, you know, he won the election in 1970 to basically become prime minister of both parts of Pakistan. And, you know, the West Pakistani government wasn't happy with that, because he was Bengali, which is a minority within, you know, within Pakistan. So an ethnic minority, I should say. So that's when sort of the idea of an independent East Bengal, which is now Bangladesh, formed. And when that movement happened, when that revolution happened, he was the one who emerged as the first president and prime minister. And so she is the daughter of this very legendary figure. But he was also, a few years after independence, assassinated because of sort of in similar ways the way Sheikh Hasina ruled, which is he installed a one-party state. He got rid of a lot of the media, you know, mainly newspapers at the time. And he, you know, just a lot of other things. People were very, very upset with the way he was running the country after he came into power.
Can you tell us more about the quota for government jobs? You write that the students have been protesting the 30% quota in government jobs for the descendants of Bangladesh's freedom fighters who had fought during 1971 and are known to be loyal to the ruling party. The High Court of Bangladesh had reinstated the quotas in June, but the students, angered by high unemployment, called it discriminatory as it disqualified merit-based candidates. So tell us more about how this works.
Yeah, so this actually stems from Sheikh Hasina's father, Sheikh Mujib. So in 1972, a year after Bangladesh's independence, he installed this quota. And the numbers have shifted a little bit over the years, but the idea was that, look, the way that Bangladesh gained its independence was through a guerrilla army, you know, farmers and peasants and just like everyday people who took up arms to fight against this very advanced Pakistani military. And that needed to be celebrated and rewarded. And the quota system sort of evolved as a result of that. So 30% of the quota in recent times was, basically awarded. So the 30% of government jobs, civil service jobs were awarded to descendants of freedom fighters. Now, there's a couple of things here. One is, if this is 1971 and now it's 2024, the descendants of those freedom fighters would be essentially their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, because these are jobs that are awarded to, like, mostly entry level, right? Like people who just graduated from college, from grad school, things like that. So people in their 20s. So one, that's kind of, you know, debatable whether that should still be a thing so many, you know, two generations later. The other thing of this, which I write about in my longer piece for New Lines, is there's been a lot of controversy around who these freedom fighters were, because it's thousands of people, like I said, in villages all over the country. And so there's been some controversy over, like, fake certificates, over corruption, over who actually was a freedom fighter during 1971 and who wasn't. So all of these things together kind of make it really hard to discern who deserves and not. The other thing is Awami League, like I said, was the party that first came into power under Sheikh Mujib, Hasina's father. And so, you know, it's kind of natural that a lot of the people that are favored for these jobs become, you know, go to, like, government, government people who are favored by the ruling party and the government. So, you know, it's discriminatory in that way.
And again, even though Bangladesh has been hailed for its booming economy, according to Al Jazeera, unemployment is rampant. 40% of young people are neither working nor in university. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely, right? So if you have 30% of this quota going to people favored by the government, then that doesn't, and then I should say there was, I believe, 10% for women and another smaller percentage for minorities, which the students did not oppose that. The solution that they proposed was not to get rid of the quota altogether, but to basically, you know, figure out if the 30% for freedom fighters made sense anymore, right? So back to sort of the economy. Yes, a lot of the discontent is over just getting a job, right? And also something that I haven't really seen talked much about, but just reporting from the country, and also, you know, being of descent, I know that there is so much corruption when you even go to get a job. So let's say you want to work in the governor's office. I'm just making this up. You probably have to, like, pay somebody off to even get that civil service job, you know? So there's so much of that. And if you are the son of a farmer who got a scholarship to, like, one of these Ivy League universities, like I described earlier, you don't have that money. to pay off, whether it's a public job, public sector job, or a private sector job. But these government jobs promise you all of those amenities without having to pay someone off, right? So yeah, it's a little bit complicated in that way.
How do you think the removal of the prime minister will affect corruption in Bangladesh?
So, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a clean sweep, and we're seeing that it's not. However, what is very admirable is that a lot of the ministers, a lot of the officials that were in charge of like really important departments, like the Ministry of Law, for example, he's been removed because he's been known to be very corrupt. And a lot of these things have been such an open secret. But again, because there are these laws called the Digital Security Act, the Cyber Security Act, that basically allowed the government to, you know, jail and penalize anybody that spoke up against the government, you know, even if you wanted to criticize a head of department somewhere. So people stayed quiet. So I think that, you know, I mean, corruption is rampant everywhere, but it is going to be slow in the, you know, slow overturn, but I think it is happening, piece by piece.
And what do people think about the Nobel laureate, Mohamed Yusuf? Yunus, who has been sworn in. He's known for his work in microcredit. What are people saying about Mohamed Yunus, and what is he saying so far about all of this? What are his plans?
Yeah, I mean, he's a beloved yet polarizing figure. He's beloved because he, you know, obviously he won the Nobel Prize. He put Bangladesh on a map in so many ways. And Bangladesh is a country that is like sandwiched in between these two major players, India and Pakistan, that is always in the news. No one really cares about Bangladesh that much, right? Even when these protests happened, I mean, as a journalist, I'll tell you, before Hasina even fled, I was pitching this story everywhere, and I was like, it's going to happen. We need to write about it. We need to, you know, create content around it. And it took a while, right, for the world to take notice. And so Yunus is an important part of that story, right? There is a lot of controversy because of his microcredit, history. And so I think some people are a little bit afraid that he is going to like sell out to, you know, Western powers. There's a neoliberalism, neocolonialism that might happen. However, you know, the general public really do see him as someone that doesn't belong to any of the major political parties in Bangladesh. So Hasina's Awami League, and then the other party, which is the Bangladesh National Party, BNP, who also was in power a few times over, you know, 53 years. And they have not been happy or seen any progress under either of these parties. And so I think having someone that belongs to none of them is considered a good thing.
We are talking about the latest from Bangladesh with Jennifer Chowdhury, a Bangladeshi-American journalist. You can read her lengthy piece in New Lines magazine called In Bangladesh, A Personality Cult Gives Way After Student Protests. Find it on our website, kalw.org. Click news and then your call. Jennifer, it really struck me when you said nobody reads about Bangladesh, nobody posts articles about Bangladesh unless you really look for them. Well, we've actually done a lot of shows about the garment workers in Bangladesh. There are over 4 million garment workers in Bangladesh. They make $113 a month. I just want to repeat that, $113 a month. And they make clothes for some of these multi-billion dollar corporations like Walmart, H&M, Gap, Target, Levi's, you name it. So what is going to happen to workers who make such low wages? And I also want to ask you, what would be a living wage in Bangladesh? But before we do that, what's going to happen to garment workers, for example, because of this ousting and these protests?
That is a very good question. And I think it's a little bit up in the air. But again, I think with Yunus having a pulse, right, and so many sort of like, so much recognition internationally, which is exactly what you need to keep that industry going. I don't want to make any predictions, but I think that is a very important piece of his, you know, governance going forward. You know, focusing on the labor laws in the country, the fair wages is really important, and which was a big miss under Hasina and really under all of the governments that have come into play in the last few decades. I can share a story. I also have done some reporting on the textiles. I wrote a piece for Elle magazine in 2018 or 2019, I believe, about a protest for fairer wages, which happened very often in Bangladesh. And the story was basically, you know, the headline was, these are the women that make your jeans for Zara. They're not getting paid fairly. And, you know, and I basically followed the protesters. I followed this one woman who ended up in the hospital. You know, there's a specific police force dedicated to sort of like taming the garment worker protesters because it happens so often. I was super surprised when that happened, when I discovered that. And so, you know, a lot of times what happens are like, it's very confusing. A lot of chaos happens when protests happen in Bangladesh for any reason. And so you have the police that are supposed to like protect, you know, the garment workers, but end up being, you know, opposing them. Then there's like local goons that are like also in the mix and trying to like, you know, fight back the garment workers. So anyway, so my story was really about following this one woman who had her head bashed in. So, because they threw a brick at her, I believe. And then from there on, you know, like I told a story about like why, you know, why they're protesting, why their wages are so low, et cetera. And that story did really well, especially because it was for like a major magazine like Elle, which doesn't tend to cover these types of topics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a few weeks it went viral. It did incredibly well. And then I get a letter. I get an email from Elle and I both get emails from the factory owner. And so they're registered in London, which allows them to basically, in a nutshell, sue journalists for defamation. There aren't the same laws in the US. It's a little harder to do that here, from what I understood at the time. And, you know, I was a freelance journalist, and so Ella had to take down the story. But, you know, just a little secret, if you Google my name and garments, you'll probably still find it on the Yahoo Syndicate. Mm. But anyway, I share this story to tell you that there's enormous economic and social power and capital in the garments industry. And when you talk to the workers themselves, they're not like, oh my God, please don't stop buying our clothes because then we won't have jobs, right? Like there's this whole movement against fast fashion and, you know, and recycling up and all of that. And, you know, they just want better wages, right? And then that is something that is really hard. And I feel it's important to say that that industry needs support. That industry needs labor regulation. The international community needs to regulate themselves harder so that the factories in Bangladesh and across Asia can do better. So I think that I hope that Yunus focuses on that and really tries to set some precedent, set some laws, some acts in place. You know, the interim government is such a precarious position right now that it's even hard to even understand how they're going to work with all the different lawmaking processes to get things done.
Speaking of wages, so you often hear people say, it's so great that all of these garment workers have these jobs. If they didn't have these jobs, you know, where would they be? But they don't talk about the wages. So yeah. $113 a month. What does it take in Bangladesh to live a life with dignity where you can provide food for your family, send your children to school? How much would that be?
I mean, at least five times that. Wow. But, you know, so to break it down, $100 or so is about 10,000 dhaka, which is their local currency. A lot of these garment workers share rooms with the families, right? They have children, they have, you know, a spouse, and they'll often split apartments. I've been to many apartments where, you know, two families will share an apartment. And I'm not even talking about this being in like the center of the city. This is like sort of like outside of the city where the factories are. And even then, and I'm talking about 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, I remember one garment worker told me that I believe her rent was 6 or 7,000 cheka out of 10, right? So that's more than 50%. So that's about $50-$60. So, and school is not free in Bangladesh. There are government schools, but they come with a lot of caveats. You still have to buy a lot of supplies. A lot of people don't even have to send their kids to those schools because it's not a, you know, great education. You know, it's a little bit complicated. But if over 50-60% of your income goes to rent, then what do you have left, right? There's no free healthcare. So if you have any sort of like health issue, you have to pay for it. Like really anything and everything. And like I said, inflation is at 10% right now, 9-10%. So food is incredibly expensive. So yeah, it's really not a living wage. And again, this is what she shared, that she shares an apartment with somebody, with another family.
Well, we're definitely going to have to do an entire show about garment workers in Bangladesh, and just to see what, if anything, changes as a result of what has been happening on the streets. We also wanted to ask you a question about journalists and what has been happening to journalists under Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. A Foreign Policy had a good piece called Bangladesh's Media Has Been Tested by Fire. And in this piece, we learned that last year, Reporters Without Borders said journalists in Bangladesh faced judicial harassment, police violence, online harassment, and attacks while out reporting. Such events have also been reported by Bangladeshi media during the recent protests. At least 5 journalists have been killed and about 200 have been injured while covering the protests. So what is it like to be a journalist in Bangladesh?
Yeah, like I said earlier about the DSA and the Cybersecurity Act, so many journalists have been jailed and detained under these acts. And, you know, actually just recently, this very prominent journalist, her name is Rosina Islam. She writes for one of the biggest national papers there, Pratham Alo. She was, you know, I think there was like a number of court cases against her, and I think they under this new interim government, she was finally released of all of that. And you know, she was heavily persecuted by the government. In fact, I was just at a journalism conference last week where I met a Bangladeshi journalist who moved to the United States, and I she sat next to me at a workshop, and I was like, she looks so familiar. And I realized she was a TV anchor for many years. And, you know, one of the reasons why she left is because she was working on a lot of press freedom issues, and the government, you know, was after her. It's very hard to be a journalist in Bangladesh. In fact, when I got to Bangladesh, and as someone who's both in and outside of that world, right, I'm up to set, but I was born and raised in the United States. I have cultural literacy, things like that. But I was very much a foreign correspondent when I was there. And so that afforded me a lot of, you know, protection. Also, the Rohingya refugee crisis brought a lot of international journalists to Bangladesh. So, you know, the international media landscape opened up a little bit. However, Hasina did not let international journalists investigate in Bangladesh very deeply. I know that she was very much against it. A lot of international press passes were revoked. But going back to local journalism, you know, a lot of regional journalists, they faced, you know, they paid heavy, heavy prices for reporting very honestly. And as we all know, local journalism, regional journalism, that's where it's at, no matter what country you're from. And then also there are a lot of exile journalists from Bangladesh that live all over Europe. And in fact, I have to shout this outlet out. It's called Netra News, N-E-T-R-A News, was founded by Kasim Khalil, who is a very prominent investigative journalist who, you know, kind of helped me with a lot of things just when I got to Bangladesh, to kind of understand the landscape of the country. And they have been reporting nonstop throughout the protests from like sort of day one. And I don't know if he's going to go back home now. Things are going to change definitely for him. But yes, you know, persecution and sort of like, you know, suppression of journalism was a big thing under Hasina's government.
Jennifer Chowdhury is a Bangladeshi American journalist who's been reporting on South Asian and Muslim communities in the diaspora for over a decade. And you can find her lengthy piece for New Lines magazine, In Bangladesh, A Personality Cult Gives Way After Student Protests, on our website, kalw.org. Click news and then your call. Jennifer, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about Donald Trump's plan to claim the election was stolen if Kamala Harris wins. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.